Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. This is episode 203. I'm joined tonight by Chris Morgan and Horton Dowden.
Good evening.
Hey everybody.
And Andrew Whitaker.
What's up, homies?
You know, by the time people hear this, it will be a couple of days until we release veteran tickets for Warzone Atlanta. Those go on sale the 31st. I think, well, people are going to get their emails very soon, and then they'll be able to pre-buy the tickets if you attended last year for a short period of time before they go up for sale to the general public.
I wonder how quickly we're going to sell out this year.
You know, last year we sold out in a matter of hours. This year I expect the same. We know there's a bunch of enthusiasm around 8th edition. We're going to use all the rules, Forge World, everything included. It's going to be the weekend of November 11th this year. Same weekend as it was last year, in the same place it was last year. So it's going to be very familiar to folks. Can't wait to start selling tickets. Horton and Andrew, you've been to 100% of the war zones.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. Yeah, we're super veterans.
Super veterans.
We're hitting on two pluses. That's how veteran we are.
So awesome. You've been on a few tours, basically.
Exactly.
This is going to be amazing. It has been every year. Forge Narrative, General Staff, Combined Forces, this is the best party in 40K. It's a great way to spend a weekend doing something you like in a cool place with a bunch of cool people. Table service, tableside drink service. We try to be relaxed, but still at the same time, an ultimately competitive event. And I think we've accomplished that.
Yeah, if you're within 1,000 miles, you have no excuse not to go. It's just that good.
Well, I want to talk about some of our sponsors, too. You know, last week, it may have been the week before, I mentioned the Impudent Mortal terrain sets. Those guys, it's at impudentmortal.com. They are giving 20% off until the end of the month, and the code for that is Warzone20, and this discount is on their Rust line. And you heard me talk about it before, but the Rust line it's laser-cut terrain, but it comes with decals. You don't have to paint it. You can assemble it and have cool-looking, you know, picturesque-type scenery elements on your table without having to paint them yourself. And that's kind of neat. That's a time saver, and they look good.
Yeah, terrain is kind of the boogeyman of hobby time, because you're always torn between the idea of like, well, I need terrain to keep my dudes alive, but I also need these dudes to put on the table to play with.
Yeah, we got 3 hours a night to, you know, or 3 hours a week maybe to get your army for tournament, you know, the tournament ready. This is a time saver. I mean, I think it's, check them out, impudentmortal.com. It's their Rust line. It's really cool buildings, scenery elements. I like it, and they're always cool to talk to. They were supported last year. Andrew, I think you said it the best when we've been talking about sponsors for FTN and Warzone and the like, is that support these folks that support us. The people that the firms and the entities and the companies that support the things that you like, they're worth checking out and seeing if you can support them too.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, you're going to buy these. You're going to, if you're a hobbyist, an enthusiast, a gamer, you're buying these products anyway. And so you might as well spend those hobby dollars and that excitement and convey it to someone else that shares the same interests to you. So if you're listening to our show, if you're reading our website, if you enjoy the list reviews, or if you're coming to our tournaments, hey, like, you know, you need to buy great terrain. So go to Infinite Mortal. No doubt the best way to encourage the stuff that you love is to go to the sponsors of the things, the events that you go to.
Yeah, I'm happy to announce another sponsor. This is Pop Goes the Monkey. It is a Shapeway store where he sells 3D printed bits and accessories for your models. This is stuff you can't get anywhere else. And this stuff is very high quality. I mean, you can see it. There's a lot of armies that use this stuff. I actually picked up some Blood Angel. He has a bunch of chapter symbols for things that have they've got the curve in them already, so, and they line up perfectly on a shoulder pad, and that's a Primaris Marine or a regular size Space Marine. And I mean, they're beautiful, very highly detailed, finely done. They're going to be a major sponsor of Warzone Atlanta this year. Real happy to talk about them. You will see, I've actually got the picture up. I was making a Blood Angel Ancient, Primaris Ancient. I put a couple pictures up on my Twitter. You will see more pictures as I build out more models. It's one of those things, you know, I can focus in getting some of this terrain ready for the big tournaments and hobby weekends, and I can kind of cleanse my palette by painting a cool Blood Angel character model. And the bits like this and the parts like this, it turns to generic Marine into a very personalized Marine that matches the rest of your army. It's amazing. And you can find that at shapeways.com/shops/pop, P-O-P, bits, pop bits.
Now, what's really cool about that is when you think about the products like that Blood Angel icon you're talking about, it's like a 3D transfer. It's it makes the shoulder pad a relief. And it also, you know, in terms of your hobby time and skill, it makes it easier to paint that symbol than, you know, doing it by hand, you know, and easier to get highlights and things on it. So I think that's a pretty cool product.
He's got a ton. Anything you can think of, including second curse foundings. I mean, it's check it out. And you can, that's where, go to the Shapeway store. And Shapeways are cool people also. But this guy, he's got a great store, a lot of variety, and everything I've gotten from him has been amazing.
I'm also a pretty big fan of their website. A lot of these times, especially for the smaller entities, you know, if you've got kind of a pop-up, it's just one guy doing cast or something like that. Their websites aren't super intuitive. They're not easy to use. I'm actually a really, really big fan of Shapeways and the Pop Goes the Monkey bits. So, easy to use, great way to randomly spend $26 during a workday. Not that I did that today, but
plausible so yeah, deniability.
I cannot confirm nor deny, Senator/wife. But yeah, it happens.
Check them out. We're going to be talking about more sponsors that we lead into Warzone. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor of Warzone, please hit us up. We have several different levels of sponsorship, and a couple of those levels include us talking about you here on the podcast. What I'm really happy about is that the sponsors that we've had are also really cool people that have been cool to talk to and stuff that I actually use. So this is, yeah, it's nice when that kind of stuff can come together and we can bring some mutual interest and awareness to everyone.
Always
nice.
Easier to sell something that you believe in, for sure.
Yeah. But this is all going to translate into cool swag, cool prizes at Warzone Atlanta. As I said, part of being the biggest party in 40K is also having some amazing prize support. And the last several years, we have had amazing prizes. And I love to give away stuff. Absolutely love giving away things.
It helps make events really cool. When you have the ability to give out big prizes, good prizes.
And I talk fast, so the award ceremonies don't last forever either.
Also
that
a plus.
That is also a benefit for those trying to take a flight home.
If you are interested in becoming a sponsor of Warzone Atlanta, hit us up on our Facebook page or through the website. Happy to talk to you. Love to have you part of the sponsorship team. But so there's some pressing 40K stuff coming up. During the middle of this show, I'm going to do a spot with the Table of Ultimate Gaming. They have a Kickstarter that's launching probably the day you hear this show, on Thursday, August the 24th. They have a Kickstarter launching. And when they say it's the Table of Ultimate Gaming, they mean it, and you're going to hear that in the middle part of the show about how they describe it. I actually talked to one of the creators, there's a couple of guys that have come together and done this, and they have an amazing background in things that have been not hobby-related, but yet quasi-related in production design and product design and product marketing and selling and stuff. And so it was really great to talk to and hear a very professional approach at this. And they talk about the Kickstarter here in the middle part of the show. So that's coming up after we do this segment here, and then we'll come back and it'll be another segment with us.
Sweet.
All of your podcasting needs are being met right here.
All the furious internet searches for all these cool things you're going to have to do. So something that came up, we have a tournament coming up here over the weekend. It's the Atlanta 40K Tournament Series, and it's a Gigabyte, an amazing store put on by the General Staff people, some of the folks that are doing Warzone Atlanta with us. And I was building a list, and I'm building a list, and look, my list is not going to be the one that proves or disproves the point or whatever, because it's mostly guard. And right now, you know, the guard are insane.
They're just real a little. Good. They're yeah. real good.
Yeah, it's hard to make a bad guard list right now, in my opinion. But with the release of the Grey Knights and the fact that I already have a Grey Knight army and I enjoy playing with them, I sat down and I built a brigade army, you know, going for that sweet, sweet big group of command points. And I thought, you know, I'd like to use my Dread Knight, and I'd like to use some of these strike squads that Purifier/strike squads. They're strike squads for me, but I built them as to be both double duty back when Grey Knights were in fifth. So I built this brigade, and then I started thinking, okay, now I'm not a Grey Knights detachment and I'm not a guard detachment. Guard doesn't care right now because they're an index army. Grey Knights do care because they're a codex army. And I wanted to kind of look at what I was giving up. Like, is this worth it for me to throw these in there or try to finagle it around to where I can make them their own separate detachment? I've ultimately decided to not make them their own separate detachment and keep the brigade and get the extra combat points. Because guard are so strong. So again, don't take the fact that this is guard plus as something to do this or to something for the exercise. But I'd like to kind of discuss what you're giving up in the future when you start blending factions together into detachments.
Yeah, I mean, this is about as close as Paul gets to having a 40K identity crisis. So, I mean, it becomes a debate between what's better, having more command points or having specific faction abilities as awarded in a codex.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, we talked about this a little bit pre-show and, you know, discussed it, not at any great length, but discussing it in the abstract. This is a really difficult topic to tackle because it's very specific to the list design. It can be a huge, massive consideration, or it can be not a factor at all right now in 8th edition because, you know, if for example, Paul was playing Blood Angels in Guard, then who cares? It's not a consideration at all because they're both index armies and there are no faction-specific rules for a faction peer detachment. So who cares? And that's the boat that a lot of people find themselves in still as we're kind of crawling along into 8th edition. But as we go forward, it certainly is a, you know, list design kind of a threshold matter that says, what am I trying to accomplish with this list, with this particular army, and what's the best way to go about that? I really truly believe that in order to compete, and I think we'll talk about this in the second half of the show, you know, there are two or three or four really apex predator list archetypes out there right now, guard being one of them, right? Paul just said it. It's really hard to build a bad guard army. You can kind of basically just play roulette with all the codex entries and you'll come up with a good army at 2,000 points. And so if you're trying to build an army to compete with those two or three top end list archetypes, you're going to need those stratagems, those faction specific special rules. If you're going to do that, if you're going to compete with those top end armies with Grey Knights.
Well, let's talk about what you give up when you do blend detachments right now. If you are a Space Marine, a Chaos Space Marine, or a Grey Knight, what you actually give up. And those are chapter tactics. And that's very important, or it could be very important, I guess. And you give up the use of the stratagems. You're able to still use relic. Relics are still open to you, and warlord traits are still open to you.
While those two are still open, I think it's very clear looking at the three codexes that we have that GW's approach to playing a single faction army as compared to a combined arms detachment army is very much in line with the words of Leonidas when he said, give them nothing, but take from them everything. The rewards are so big for playing single faction. I think it is a decision that can only be made with a very heavy heart if you do decide to take a combined force.
That's what they promised us. I mean, they did say that you were essentially, I don't know if it was explicitly stated, but it was heavily implied that if you dedicated yourself to a faction for your army, then you would see benefits, you would see rewards, and that is, I think that's going to be the case. And I mentioned that you still get the warlord traits and you still get the relics, but you're giving up many of the army special rules, such as things like objectives secured. Now, that's situational. Sometimes it really matters. Sometimes it doesn't. But for instance, in a Chaos Space Marine, you're giving up the Legion traits. So you'd be giving up several of the powerful things that we've talked about in previous episodes. And that's just one thing. You're giving up at least two pages of special rules for your army if you choose to decide to blend detachments.
And that's something I think we need to put some extra emphasis on. First, that it's detachment-based, not army-wide, right?
Yeah, so it's Battleforged and then XXX detachment. So if your army has to be Battleforged first, and then that detachment benefits from the detachment rules.
And the second thing is, oftentimes, these decisions when we're making army lists, we kind of make automatically in our heads, where you have a strategy in mind, you have a technique, it's your go-to, right? Say it's the character and the two units that he buffs that you always put in each army, and you have a specific stratagem per se that allows you to do a trick on the table. You have to turn that switch off in your head and understand that you are now giving up that, I don't want to call it a crutch, but that automatic sort of taking for granted, I can do this ability.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what Chris just said, and the second kind of leg to that is that because it's detachment, specific, not army wide, right? To dovetail off what Chris said, right now in 8th edition, especially competitive play, we're basically in an unbound world, right? Because three detachments is a ton. Most tournaments are limiting you to three detachments, and then the versatility of those detachments is just wild. I mean, I need a bunch of fast attack units. Cool. Slap in an extra Outrider unit, and the only tax you're paying is, I guess, an HQ choice?
Yeah, like a single HQ for a lot of those specialist ones.
Exactly. And then they're not – I mean, there's a ton of really good HQ choices across the armies, unless you're a Tau player. Well, even then you've got commanders, so like, you know, the HQ tax isn't really that much of a tax to pay, and so bearing that in mind, it's pretty easy to fit the non-faction units you want into your army without defiling, quote unquote, the detachments that you want to get those faction specific rules out of. Really, it's just a matter of, you know, taking the time, thinking through how can I fit these pieces of the puzzle together. There's too much flexibility. You really, really, really shouldn't ever have to cost yourself those faction-specific rules.
I think that you bring up a good point about how to build the list. Like when you're going through and trying to figure out what army you want to play, and if you're trying to be competitive, I mean, if you are trying to win a bunch of games, you can list out all the units you want. Find the efficient units, find the ones that have the value, find the ones that perform a specific function that you think you're going to need, and then you can put them in. You basically just kind of move them around until they fit into all the three detachments that you need. And then call it a day. I mean, that's it. That's one of the best ways to do it. But with things like you could be going for a specific detachment, such as a brigade or whatever, and you might be tight on points. Like maybe you have it locked down to as much as you want, but you've only got 50 points left for an HQ, and you have to fill that last slot, so you may have to go outside of your detachment. I mean, that's worst case, and that's kind of far out. But I do think that you will be able to build almost everything with the codexes within the detachments, to your point.
If you're going after the brigade specifically, most lists I've seen that go after the brigade, it's not because the brigade is big and shiny and has lots of spare slots. It's because of the extra command points that it gives you, right? It gives you more than if you took like an Outrider, a Vanguard, and a battalion, right? So that the brigade itself is like, how can I make the most efficient way to get lots of command points?
How do I get my 12 command points?
Yeah, how do I get my magic number of infinity 12 command points? And so, you know, that could... So it's about the quest for more command points over the quest for more slots.
It is important, though, that with the command points, you lose the strat... And this is what you lose. This is the big things that you lose. You lose some of the army special rules, and then specifically the stratagems, the faction-specific stratagems. And that could be big.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And it's just so easy to avoid, then don't do it. I guess that's the ultimate message that I'm taking away from this, is that given three detachments, given that it's detachment-specific, you know, the pros to cons ratio here is, man, if you are in a tiny, tiny percentage of list design situations, if you're literally thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, there's no way for me to fit this army together the way I want it, except to mash this 30-point, you know, Imperial Guard HQ into my Grey Knights detachment.
See, or you could be like me. I just want to play with the Dread Knight. I just want to play with the Grandmaster Dread Knight.
Yeah, well, in that case, just take a command detachment or whatever. You know, like.
But I also want my 12 command points.
Well, yeah, there you go. I mean, in your
boat, I'm playing guard. It's different.
You're playing guard, right? Exactly. It's different. It's, and then also, like, you don't have any faction-specific rules to speak of because you're still in the end.
Nothing's being sacrificed to that at this point. But then we will see, especially when we get more codexes, that's the path, is that you will be rewarded in the form of getting access to everything in your book if your detachments are aligned faction-wise. Your army doesn't have to be. You could have, as long as the army is battle-forged and fills out the right detachments, then as long as those detachments are pure, you'll still get all the rules.
Well, I 1,000% guarantee you that come February, when you and I are playing together at table 3 of Atlanta 40K series in February of 2018, there won't be any, you know, SNGs, you know, schmucks and giggles, Dreadknight in your faction pure guard army. You're not giving up stratagems to play with your Grandmaster Dreadknight.
I think you're right.
Yeah. So that's
That's probably more of a novelty decision at this point, Paul.
You could be right, but I want to talk about what was because this could start coming up is what people are giving up. They may not realize they're giving up until it's too late. Like they could be in game two, round five, or you know, turn five, and realize they can't use the stratagem that they wanted to use. And it's important to talk about, I think.
Sure. It is. And so, again, the point seems to be if you have good stratagems in your codex, then you probably don't want to give them up. But if you, because I've played with and against a lot of these and stratagems are crazy good, but if you don't have a codex, then you don't have anything to give up. And so if the majority of your army is that index that doesn't have the stratagems to lose, then sure, do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
If we can change a little bit topics to a completely fluff and lore discussion, SNGs as it were.
Such as it is.
Oh, man. Color me interested.
Well, it's about you, Chris Morgan. You actually went out and spent some time with one of our good buddies, Carl Tuttle.
That's right. It was pretty awesome. I had an opportunity to head out there kind of as an end of summer semester present to myself. Arranged to meet up with Carl, and boy, he sure showed me around all of the cool places to hobby over in his area in San Jose. The main, of course, feature of our visit was pre-recording for the Blood Angels Show of Force called the Angelic Host.
And that's on the Independent Characters. Carl Tuttle is the host of the Independent Characters podcast. Just for anyone who might not be aware, you never know.
Yeah, there might be one or two of them out there. But so we did some recording for that. And we also did a tour of the Game Castle stores that are out there. Some really, really impressive hobby stores that have a great selection on one and then a humongous table space on the other. They do the Bay Area Open is done at Game Castle. I forget which one it is, but it's this giant kind of building. You can easily fit like 200 players in there, well ventilated and in a nice kind of strip mall sort of area. So that that was super cool. Got a chance to meet the owner there. Talked to him about doing some product testing for some markers, because who doesn't need markers for their army ever, right? So that was pretty cool. But it was, and we also had an opportunity to roll some dice at Carl's house, and he drove me around in his Porsche around the scenic area. We came back, we rolled dice, went back to the airport, and it felt like this mini vacation for me. And I just want to say a big thank you to Carl for treating me with such style while I was out there. And I'm really excited for you guys to hear that Show of Force that's coming out next month.
No, it'll be good. They always do. It's very quality podcasting. I mean, it's super focused on things, very informative by good folks. And now even an awesome, more awesome one, Chris Morgan.
Well, you know, I have an international reputation as a hopeless fanboy that I have to maintain. And this certainly helps me with that image.
Yeah, it's really.
Chris, are you going to make it to Warzone this year?
Well, it's going to depend on how much the plane ticket costs. That's a big factor for me. I'm coming up in my last semester at school. The idea is to make it there, though. It's right in kind of the perfect weekend for me to make it up there. So as soon as I can hammer down the budget 100%, the plan is right now, yes, especially because I want to finally meet Andrew and share bombastic, wild stories and statements.
That's my international reputation, obviously, is the bombastic stories and whatnot. But yeah, that'll be great. Hopefully you can make it. Would be awesome to have you here. You know, it's interesting. We're just sidetracking back to the Independent Characters podcast. It's fascinating when I watch these games and when I listen to, you know, other podcasts, friends of our show, and just kind of there's such a huge 40K community across the country and internationally. It just is always awe-inspiring to me how different the metas are and how competitive 40K looks so different in different parts of the country, and how people are bringing lists that we're just not.
Are you talking about pre or post Stormraven nerf? Is what you're telling.
Well, yeah. Well, certainly. The Stormraven nerf helped a lot. Because
it looked real similar about 4 weeks ago.
It was pretty uniform about a month and a half ago. That's fair. But even harkening back to previous editions, 7th and 6th, I mean.
No, you're dead on. I agree with you. I just thought it was funny how that was something we all came to awareness on.
Yes. Across the pond. Yes. As it were.
Stormraven, as it turns out, is the universal language. That's what they were speaking at the Tower of Babel before it got collapsed. They
all spoke Stormraven. And a merry Stormraven to you, sir.
And then God scrambled the languages. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. That kills me.
but no, I mean, Paul, this weekend, you know, obviously, Atlanta 40K Series, big, big tournament badge. I mean, I think we're scheduled to have 25, 30 players in an RTT, which is pretty standard for around here. You know, the guys from East Tennessee, the East Tennessee Hereticus, who are, you know, always a big staple up at ATC, good batch of players from up there, always make splashes at Warzone. You know, I think they're bringing 3 or 4 players down. And we were having this conversation. I was having this conversation with a local. They kind of reminded me of what Chris was talking about how we have no idea what even the guys from East Tennessee are playing and practicing with and what their experiences are in 8th edition. They may have cracked the code.
I better get these Grey Knights out of my list just to be sure.
That's exactly right. Maybe they have like the instant, like maybe they've thought up the anti-guard. I don't know. But I think that's the beauty of the 40K kind of competitive circuit across the country. A lot of fun.
Yeah, especially right now.
The cool thing about going over and playing with Carl was, you know, a lot of that heavy list building pressure was off because the main goal was to give him a game experience of this is what Blood Angels are. Like, these are the Blood Angels units. So we weren't building for a tournament style game experience, but it was amazing how close the game ended up being despite that. You know, when two people can agree to a way of playing, it's so easy to just roll dice and have a good time. And I think we successfully delivered that experience with Carl. And there's plenty of pictures up on the IC's Facebook page. I think it's facebook.com/independentcharacters. And then also on our Facebook page where we took pictures of some of the big action, including when my 10-man Sanguinary Guard ate a charge from 3 Wraith Lords.
Well, you were also playing the Open War deck, and I'd like to...
That's right,
You guys were playing Power Level using the Open War deck, and I wouldn't mind you talking about your experience with that.
Well, Power Level is an interesting animal, and I will come out full disclosure and say that I really dislike making lists with Power Level, because it feels like, especially when you're building towards a number like 100, it feels like if I'm going to build any synergies in an army whatsoever, whether I'm going competitive or not, like I really don't have the flexibility to, you know, all right, I'm going to pull a Power Fist out of this unit. And now this works. That margin for error is so much lower. The Open War deck itself was really interesting because we picked the objectives and the mission by random. You pick a random deployment out of, like, I think it's 12 cards. And then there's a bevy of different mission types. And this was a Power Level style kill points that awarded, I think it was called Grudge Match. And essentially it awarded kill points equal to a unit's Power Level, but you doubled it if it was a vehicle, monster, or character.
This is all explained on the card. Oh. You flip a card over it, and that's what your objective is, right?
Yep. And then finally there's a quirk, a mission quirk. And in ours, in this case, was no leadership test required. So we could basically go all in and we didn't have to worry about leadership mechanics and all that. It was a straight knockdown, drag out brawl, kill as many of the big things as you can. And, you know, being a Blood Angel player and their strategies are so focused around their characters, that was a little nerve wracking at times, seeing some of them die and Carl's score jump up. We ended at 130 to 116 for total score. And I ended up pulling out the win at the very last turn of the game. It's specified on the card that the game ends on turn 5. So on turn 5, I made a big gamble, charged the Avatar with my Sanguinary Guard, almost unbuffed. You know, I put the psychic power into the extra attack instead of the invulnerable save, just hoping they would kill it. And then used my other psychic power to Superman smite a Hemlock Wraith Fighter out of the sky with my Jump Librarian. He was a total beast. Loved it. It was a really fun game. And cheers to Carl for, I mean, he was ahead for most of that game, and it got right down to the wire. So fun.
Did you get a sense from the open war deck that all the stuff kind of meshed well with each other? Like you could have flipped over any of those cards in the sequence and it would have played pretty well?
I think so. And it's you know, being my first experience with it, it's hard to use one game as a metric for all of them. However, Carl fully endorses them and has had a super good time with them. I feel like in our army's case, worrying about leadership wasn't necessarily a big deal. I had some defenses that were built in there. I had a Sanguinary Guard Ancient, which of course makes you fearless. But him dying meant that if I had a unit that took some casualties, I didn't really have to worry about it. Armies that depend on that sort of mechanic, like I would say Dark Eldar being one of them, anything that causes a fear-like effect, such as, say...
But that's just a rule of the mission. You could be disadvantaged in a mission and have it be just fine. I'm just more along asking about the fact that it seemed...
Are they all playable?
Like, it was all the combinations that you saw, did it seem playable?
Yeah, it did. It absolutely did. And some of those mechanics I would love to throw into some mission design ideas as a way of, you know, we're always on Forge the Narrative looking for the best kind of missions, using missions as a balancing element. And I feel like some of those elements into our competitive style missions could work to balance out some of the crazy list designs that even though GW is right on top of it, you know, having good mission design and encouraging a diverse sort of army makeup. I think, Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, you're the one talking about a dearth of list designs in 40K right now. I feel like having a diverse mission set could do that. And I think the open war deck could provide some inspiration for that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've had this conversation with a number of mission designers. And I think if you're a mission designer right now, yes, I agree with you. Missions will encourage list diversity, right? 1,000%. And that's what you saw in 7th Ed, at the tail end of 7th edition, where mission designers were like, how can we punish the guys who are bringing the unkillable Death Star or whatever? And so that's where you could use missions to encourage list diversity. Right now in 8th, I think we're struggling because a lot of times an Imperial Guard player like me or Paul is going to say, I really don't care what the mission says. I'm going to spend the first three turns tabling you, and then the last three turns just getting the mission points that I want.
Scooting somebody over to do something.
Exactly. Like, I'm just going to, like, you know, move in advance with this vet squad and camp this objective, and lo and behold, now I win. And so I do think it is. There's two parts to that. And Chris, to your point, there are some things that mission designers can do to promote list diversity and quality, you know, list designing at events. But at its core, I think the thing that's going to solve 8th edition competitively in the near term is more faction-specific rules. It's the codices, right? You know, it was Grey Knights weren't a tournament army until they got their codex. They weren't a tournament army in Index 2. Now they are. Right.
And well, so sure. But still, with all things being equal, though, once everything settles down, it will be the things that missions is what makes. And missions also make things enjoyable. I mean, you can sit around. Sure. Like, I enjoy just playing sometimes and just rolling dice and removing models. And that's fine. I still do that to this day. But having some objective to complete that maybe your army's really good at and your opponent has to come up with a way to figure out how to stop you, or you're not good at and you've got to figure out a way to overcome the odds. That's good. And I think to the point of the open war deck is that there, how many different, I mean, there's some number, there's more than five of things to do. There's a bunch of things that you could flip over that'd be anything in there, and they're all different. And I think the point Chris trying to make, though, is that they're neat concepts that could find some way to work themselves into even competitive style missions. And the open war deck is not designed to be tournament competition. I just used air quotes.
Right. Well, and that being said, one thing that we need to, I think, create in competitive mission design isn't necessarily being shackled into the idea of this is what the Eternal War missions, quote unquote, say an objective has to be. Well, this is what a relic must be, for example, or there must be a relic in the missions because we're trying to stay close to the rule book. And what I like about the open war deck and the creative possibilities that are there is that it's an invitation to think outside the box from a mission designer's perspective. And yeah, a lot of these combinations are random, and I'm not saying we should take the open war deck and you just use that for competitive 40K, but elements of that strategically put into a two-day mission pack could create situations where some of these one-dimensional, two-dimensional army list designs are not performing well in two or three of those missions, whereas a more balanced or all take all comers style of army list may be able to do all of them pretty good and take the cake.
Well, first of all, I have played a game with Open War. It was just a pickup game, but we had a lot of fun, and I really liked the Open War concept. But tying that in to some other things y'all have been saying is when you go to play an Open War game, just like when you go, if you go and roll a random mission or draw a random card, you don't know what you're going to be playing. So hypothetically, kind of like what Chris was just saying, if you don't know what you're going to be playing and you're trying to bring a list that you want to have some, and you want to have more likely odds to win with, then it's going to be more balanced to have better odds to win the random thing you're trying to do. While Open War, purely as it is right now, is you probably don't want to do that for a tournament, as fun as it may or may not be, as fun as it probably
will be. Well, it'll be fun for some people, and the people that got the weird draws might not be as fun for. And you don't want that, I don't think, at a tournament.
But that random element is very interesting. That's actually what Mike Twitchell and I have been doing in our events, is the missions are random. It's from a list, but you don't know what you're going to be playing until you roll it. So you better be balanced, because you might play kill points all day. You might not play them at all.
That's pretty interesting. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about some more list design concepts, some things that we're playing and painting and working on. I painted a Harlequin over the last couple of days.
It sounds like a two-day job.
It was a two-day job, only because I'm terrible at it, but I'll explain that journey here in a couple of minutes. So hang in, guys. We're going to have the talk with the Table of Ultimate Gaming guys, and we're going to hear about their Kickstarter that is launching the Thursday that you're hearing this show. So if it's really worth checking out. If you've got a table you're playing on, you're going to want to see this. It's pretty cool stuff. Anyway, hang tight, and then after that, we'll come back.
Sounds good.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Paul from Forge the Narrative. I am joined today by Pat Mayer.
Yeah, hey, thanks very much for having me.
Well, this is you have a Kickstarter that's launching today. Now, we're not doing the recording on the day it's launching, but when you hear this, the Kickstarter for the Table of Ultimate Gaming will be live.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we're excited to finally launch this. The support's been great, and we appreciate coming on and chatting with you a little bit about it.
You can find this on Kickstarter. It's also on the website, ultimategametable.com. Those links will be in the show notes. Check it out. This is something that it caught my eye as soon as I saw it. It looks amazing. It has tons of features, but I want to hear you talk about it. You know, how did you come to a point where you're going to be making something you can confidently call the Table of Ultimate Gaming?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, it's as we mentioned, it's going to be available on Kickstarter here very shortly right now. And that's crowdfunding just to help get this entire concept off the ground for everyone. But it's really been crowd design, you know, and for the past couple months, we've slowly but rapidly grown our community on Facebook, on Twitter, on email, just direct conversations with people, even on the phone. Great representation. We had a couple tables at Gen Con and a few booths, and spent just a tremendous amount of time really vetting ideas and then getting a lot of new ideas and taking all of that input and making rapid changes based on that real world feedback from the community. And, you know, this is definitely something that the crowd has designed. So that's what's really super exciting about it. They've, you know, our the people out there that are the fans of the Table of Ultimate Gaming have been able to not only provide feedback, but in some cases see the feedback resultant changes, you know, the next day. And we constantly, you know, feed that feedback loop back out to social, get their, get that input back. And that's something we're going to continue to do.
And this is made out of birch, I believe. It's with solid wood.
It is, yeah. So the production process, and one reason why the tables go together so nice and they look so beautiful when you unpackage them is we use CNC machines, so computer-aided cutting machines. So these machines are, you know, it's a robot cutting plywood, essentially, high-quality hardwoods. And over the past few years, as we've gotten a deeper understanding of that process and, you know, in that chain of supply, we've realized that we really have to use what amounts to some of the best woods out there for the CNC machines to cut properly and to cut well. So part of it is part of the reason for using this northern grown European birch wood panels is that it's a very dense, hard material because the growing seasons are short. So that's where you get some of the best wood, but also because it machines very well and we can cut it smoothly. It finishes beautifully. So both of those things result in, you know, an excellent product, very hard product, very stable, sturdy product, something that's going to literally last a lifetime without exaggeration. So use in this case, definitely using the best raw materials is a win-win for both manufacturing and also for our fans out there.
But just the nature of Kickstarter, people are going to be able to probably buy in at different levels. And you've got a bunch of different options for how people want to use this gaming table. And it's not just an option in the way the table functions, but it's also different options about how it looks.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So for us, the word ultimate in the table of ultimate gaming also means, you know, affordable and or just setting up the table the way that you want it for your particular game. So we try to put enough modularity and flexibility into the design so you really don't have to make too many compromises and you just create the product that you want. So we're starting the Kickstarter at $599. So you can get into one of these tables, you know, very affordably. And it's going to be a table, even as the base table, that probably offers more features and functionality than even high-end custom tables that run into the many thousands of dollars. So, for instance, standard table, all the hardwoods available in three colors, natural birch, a storm gray, a pitch black, so you can pick from a number of different base colors. The next thing that you get with that standard table is both power outlets and USB charging on both ends of the table. So plenty of places for people to plug in their phones. If you want to run a laptop, if your gaming entails using tablets or whatnot, and just have the convenience of the power right there on the table if you're going to be gaming for hours. Also, one really cool thing is that the table is all the tables are available with the ability to adjust the depth height of the play surface. So you can either set up a depth of 1 3/4 inches, which is, you know, a real shallow play, or you can set up a depth that is 3 3/4 for more dungeon crawls, or, you know, certainly in this case, you know, figural play, you know, 40K, anything along those lines. So it's got a lot of flexibility on, you know, the type of play that you do and how that.
And it goes flat as well. So like if they were getting the 4x6 surface, that would be a 4x6 flat surface.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's two sizes tables, 3 foot by 5 foot table. And then what we're really excited about, especially for your audience, is the full 4x6 table. So you can fit full, you know, full terrain boards in it you know, have something that you can start playing right away. From there, you know, the options are fantastic. Great cup holders that have integrated dice trays and storage trays in them. We've got, you know, for guys who are doing card playing, we have some amazing card holders and organizers. We've got, you know, DM screen and player screens for RPG players and Dungeons and Dragons crew and just many accessories along those lines. We also have full table covers. So there's times when you just might want to either cover up an ongoing game to protect it for later, or you just might want to use your table, you know, time to eat pizza and, you know, have a bite or whatever, and we've got full table covers. Interesting thing about those full table covers is there's actually 4 sections, and when you remove them and want to get back to gaming, you can store them right inside the table. So my partner and I, Jamie, you know, we're not big fans of trying to find a place for those. You know, where do we put them in the closet? I lean them against the wall. What do we do with these tabletops? So we decided to integrate them. You can slide them right inside the table, and they're completely put away. But then further, what's exciting is you can pull those.
This is a neat option. This is a very neat option.
Yeah, thanks. We're really excited about it. You can pull those back out a fair bit, and it operates just like a desk. So by getting that full table cover option, you not only get the ability to completely cover the table up, but you also, when you're ready to game, you can store those away, but then have four desks, four adjustable length desks for all your writing and storage and put your figures down or cards or whatever the case may be. So, you know, those are just some of the options. Then from there, the tables themselves are modular. So if 4x6, you want to go bigger, you can put two 4x6 tables end to end on the short end, and you can have a 4x12 table. You can put a 4x6 table side to side and end up with an 8x6 table. So you got 40, you know, tremendous, you know, amount of space. Same thing with the 3x5s. And if you want to go longer, you can go longer. I mean, theoretically, it's no exaggeration. You could make a 100 or 200 or 300 foot table, which is silly, but it shows the flexibility of the ability to drop the sides and go modular.
Well, they fit together smooth too. It looked like a seamless table, as if it were built that
Absolutely.
Way. It did not look like two tables that were pushed together.
Yeah, where the table where the tables join, you know, those are all the pieces are cut by the machine, cut by the robot, cut by the computer. So it just doesn't make mistakes, you know. So if we say this is how it cut, that's how the first one's cut, and that's how the number 1000 is cut. And what that means is when you have modular systems like this, they just simply go together. And in our toolkit, we like to kind of joke a little bit. Our toolkit is included, though it's not too exciting. It's one hex wrench, right? So,
well, I was going to mention that when people order this, it will come, and some of the pieces are put together. Like, I guess some of the more complicated pieces are already assembled, but the putting the table, like the legs on, you do that at home.
That's right, and that's really that really helps both us keep the cost down in shipping, and then it makes it really affordable at the end of the day for, you know, for the consumers and the fans buying the table. So I would say, you know, you can, you know, one person can do it. If you got two people doing it, that's great too. It's a 30-minute process, 35-minute process. All the long rails and the sides and the things like that, we all pre-assemble at the factory. So you get just a series of bolts. There's nothing complicated. It's not, you know, it's not a complicated procedure. It's just bolt, 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 bolt. You tighten them up. And
if you put together IKEA furniture before, you can do this no problem.
If you put it together IKEA furniture before, you'll be thrilled putting this together because it's so much easier. Yeah, but that's the general idea, right? The advantage there is that, like they, we are able to, you know, ship what they call flat pack, right? So it comes to you real affordably. And that also lets us, that, you know, that's going to be one of the things that lets us extend our reach and make affordable shipments to folks in Australia, in Germany, in the UK, in the EU, and elsewhere. So, you know, like I say, we're not in the furniture business, right? We're basically boxing up systems based on the customization requirements of the consumer. And then one thing I failed to mention, but is one of the really most interesting things, and we're just going to have a long series of skins, you can call them, right, for the tables. We've got these removable, almost instantly removable and replaceable deco packs. So there's actually 18 for every table, 18 complete sets of pieces that you can snap onto the table, Celtic knots and dragons, and we're going to certainly have sci-fi and space.
And the skulls.
And the skulls, yeah. So, I mean, literally, we're only able to provide a few in the Kickstarter because of the limitations of Kickstarter and time, but we have a deep bench, mostly delivered by, you know, the community, deep bench of great styles and variations. So you can really customize the color, customize the design, and you know, make the table your own. And then I guess the last thing I'd say on design is that in the near future, after we get just past the Kickstarter, we're going to be offering with those decos some modularity. Some customization to the modularity, which means if you got a gaming club or you've got a shop or a cafe or for gaming, and or if you just at home, you just want to have a, whether it's your name or your symbol or whatever, we're going to offer customization, and people can reach out to us.
Is that be through the website?
It is. Yeah, that'll be through the website, and just another fun way to make the table your own.
Just to paint the picture for everyone, what you've described is a really nice table that has one of this. You can either use it with a sunken surface for different, like I've seen a bunch of those. I don't know what the name of the brand is, but like almost like 3D dungeons that people can line up and sit within the table, move your characters around. It's got a lip to catch your dice, or you can customize the surface with all the parts that you're getting with the table to make it a flat, almost like dinner table.
That's
regular, or what I consider a traditional normal gaming table.
That's exactly. Accurate.
That's, and then you've got all these skins that go on top of this that you could change the look up seasonally if you wanted.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, maybe you just want to, we actually have some just basic sort of wood plates, we'll call them, that just make your table look very innocuous. So, I don't know, maybe when the normal neighbors come over, you have a normal table, but when it's time to game, you pull out the skulls, right? So that's, and literally just takes seconds. So that's what's fun about it. You can switch, you know, you can buy different deco packs and literally like you kind of reskin your background on your, you know, your PC or something, or, you know, your phone. The idea here is that let's give people the ability to kind of reskin their table in a way that not only is easy, but when you buy into the skull pattern, you're not locked in. You know, you can switch that out and buy something else, switch something else out. So it's a lot of fun.
Now, obviously, this is a Kickstarter we're talking about, and Kickstarter has its own risks and challenges and whatnot. But you already have some of these. Like, I've seen the unboxings on your Facebook page where you have some of these in hand already. You've proven the process. You know you can get these made. What are some of the other risks and challenges of the Kickstarter in your mind?
Yeah, no, that's a real fair question. And I would say for a lot of Kickstarters, it's even more of a, you know, say a concern. We're very, very fortunate. I mean, we definitely need the support of the community and, you know, the orders and the support to get this line and this brand off the ground and to make it everything that we know it can be. And, you know, I think we're going to see hopefully that happen. However, from a manufacturing standpoint, this is something where that's already taken care of. I mean, we have fantastic partners. We're, you know, cutting on Italian CNC machines. We have fantastic water-based paint systems. And as you've seen, we've already unboxed pre-production type product, and even have had it at Gen Con and getting it out for different testers. So the good news there is that that's all very well in hand. And, you know, Jamie, my partner, and I, we've been in the toy and consumer products business for our whole careers, almost 50 years combined, frankly. And, you know, we understand every aspect of it. So today, when we look at an opportunity like this, we spend a lot of our time removing risk, right? Removing risk for the brand, for ourselves, and certainly for consumers. So when this hits Kickstarter, certainly the most important thing is, you know, hopefully we get a lot of support that we can, you know, get into production and really make this exciting. And then from there, start adding on a lot of features in the future. But as to whether we'll ship and when we'll ship, that's one of the most exciting parts too, because we're going to be shipping very early with good support. And I think the consumers are going to see their tables in literally a fraction of the time compared to what they might expect from a lot of Kickstarter projects.
That's awesome. I think people will be very happy to hear that, because once they see them and commit to getting one, you're going to be want to rolling dice on it as soon as possible.
You got that right.
I mean, that's pretty cool. And there's other accessories you're talking about too. Like, I've seen almost like a rolling cabinet.
Yeah. Well, thanks for mentioning that. Boy, are we excited about that. So the internal, that's sort of now been a little external nickname for those, are Hell Tower and Hell Boxes. And that's our storage system. And that comes from, it's kind of interesting, that came from just the quickest little story here. So back in the beginning of before the turn of the century, two centuries back, not this one, when they used to do typesets, you know, they used to have you've seen those little individual typesets that they used to print the early newspapers out of, all those individual A's and B's and C's and that. Well, they'd print these papers and then they'd all get dumped into a box. And it was the apprentice, they called him the devil's apprentice at the print shop. He'd have to sort through all those, take them all out of the box, clean them, and get them back on the rack. And it was just a horribly tedious job. And they called that the Hell Box. So a lot of storage boxes today, and for some gamers and just some people in general, the nickname is Hell Box. So we decided to create our own, picking up on a lot of the great styles and modularity that we have. So you'll be able to take these boxes and not only store them within these great towers that we're going to have that then will roll right under the table. So it's a complete system. But then also we're going to even have some great takeaway storage bags too, so you can put them in a bag and take them out to you know, the gaming store or to your friends or whatever. So a lot of fun on the storage side coming.
That's pretty cool. I like that a lot. And will that have similar deco packs to match the tables and stuff?
Exactly. So you can buy the deco packs to match your table, and that'll be an ongoing series of colors. So you can match your table color, you can match your table deco. and you know, really have a system that you know, and it's definitely going to be one of those you know, things when you walk into the room and you see all that, it's gonna be like, wow, it's gonna be a showstopper. And that's our intent too, is, you know, part of everything that we're doing here is, it starts with a clean sheet of paper and starts with design. I mean, that's Jamie's my partner, Jamie McBain. He's the designer behind really the vast majority of this, and he's just doing amazing work.
Well, I can say, just looking over this stuff, you know, when you're going down your checklist of like what I would do if it were me kind of thing or whatever, like, oh, it would be cool if it had this. Well, the table of Ultimate Gaming seems to have it right now. I mean, you guys have already done that and you've answered most of the questions. So now, you know, when I say it'd be great if it had a USB charger on there. Oh, it does. It has power. Oh, it does. What am I going to do with the slats? Oh, they can turn them into desks or, you know, little miniature holders or whatever. It's all there.
It is. And I have to tell you, I wish we could claim all the credit for that, and Jamie too, but he'd be the first to admit that the reason that it seems like that, especially at this point as we're launching the Kickstarter, is because many of those ideas were either offered or, you know, input modified by the community, right? So all those come from great ideas. So, you know, that the crowd design is super exciting part of this whole feature. So that's why it seems like it has all the bells and whistles and ideas, is because thousands of people were able to put their input into it, and we were able to just sort of try to manage and distill and curate that into something that is this ultimate, you know, this ultimate table of gaming. So,
well, I just know, talking to you and hearing a little bit about your background, it's instilled confidence within me that, you know, this is what you're doing right now. You've been working with wood and things like this for quite some time. So these are not alien concepts or alien products to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, going back to when both Jamie and I were, you know, preteens and sitting in our basement, making our way through Chicago winters, playing Dungeons and Dragons, to everything that we've done. I mean, you know, we've made, I've made all the Halo action figures from Microsoft, the first series of Halo, things with Universal Studios and Disney, and just many, many things. And even Jamie today continues to do work for many of the top companies like Mattel and Hasbro and other people out there. So we definitely have the chops. We know what we're doing. We're excited, though, to really apply it to something that we're passionate about, right? And I think, and I hope you've started to see some of that come through in the product.
No, absolutely. I mean, you can tell. I mean, this just, again, it has a lot of the check boxes already checked, the questions answered. Now it's just going to be a question of, when do we get it? When do we get to play on this thing?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it looks nice. And I like the way you mentioned that you have a way of kind of, if you did get this and put it in your house, in your main living area, then it would, to the average person, it would look normal. It's the table of Ultimate Gaming.
That's right, right. Full of surprises, right? Like, it's like a Pandora's box, right? That's cool.
Man, that's awesome. So with the Kickstarter, what are people going to be able to choose colors there?
Yeah.
What are some of the things that they choose at the time? And then what are some of the things they choose later? And who's going to handle your pledge manager and what afterwards?
Yeah, thanks. That's great. So sort of the journey through our Kickstarter is, you know, you'll come in and first you'll be able to pick a table size. So 3 foot by 5 foot, or a 4 foot by 6 foot, or several of those if you're intent is to put them together, or whatever the case may be.
You're outfitting your game in the store.
That's right.
Four new tables or whatever.
Could be, absolutely. Or you might, some folks are already looking at doing 1 3x5 as a coffee table, and then doing 1 4x6 as a, you know, play 40K on the 4x6 and maybe do a normal gaming or play with the kids on the coffee table. So you have those sort of choices to start with. So after you choose the size and or regular or coffee table height, you can move on to your color. Natural birch, storm gray, pitch black, then look at things like cup holders and tabletop covers and all the different array of accessories. So you can move through the Kickstarter, make your pledge levels, make those, make those selections. And then 35 days later, we will finish that pre-sale. And of course, everything's discounted heavily during the Kickstarter. So all the prices are really attractive. So after that, there's about a week, I think, as things consolidate. And then we're using CrowdOx, and CrowdOx will be the kit that goes out. That'll be the survey to each and every buyer to confirm, what they want, and any other colors and configuration, certainly on the deco, you know, if they wanted dragons or they wanted skulls. It's also an opportunity to make a change at that point, too. They can change or add things if they'd forgotten about something, or maybe they want a card holder or a DM screen
or
something, right?
They were on the fence about the cup holders.
And yeah. And I have to say another reason why that might happen is that over the course of Kickstarter, some of those accessories were just going to continue to get better images and video and updates and discussions and hands-on video. So 35 days is fast, but it's also, you know, a little bit of time, and you'll see a lot of information come out during that time. So by the end of that period, some people may see something that'll, you know, maybe make them want to include some additional parts and products. And then at that point, you know, that gets finalized. It's really, CrowdOx is a great piece of software, very highly integrated with some of the world's biggest Kickstarter projects. And I think the consumers will love to use it. And at that point, everything gets locked in and we go do what we do best, which is go make these tables of Ultimate Gaming.
That's awesome, man. Well, Pat, thanks for talking with me. And if it's okay, I'd like to follow up with you guys. I know that during the campaign, it might be very hard to, because I think running a Kickstarter is like a full-time job. So right, I hope you're prepared. Right. It sounds like you are. But maybe right after it closes, we can check in and see how things went and, you know, get more information from you, I'm sure, as things evolve over the life of this campaign.
Absolutely. Looking forward to the follow-up with you.
Pat, I'm going to be tracking it. I'll be giving people updates along the way on the show for the next few weeks. And man, I can't wait to see where this goes.
Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Have a good night.
Yep. Thanks very much.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Chris Morgan and Andrew Whitaker.
Trogdor, the Burninator.
What's up, homies?
And Horton Doughton.
Hey.
Thanks for tuning in again after the break. Listen to that cool thing. Check out the Kickstarter. I mean, I can't say it enough. It's very neat. There's been some things that have been on the market that are similar to it before, but they have a really unique way, I think, of going about it and scratching that itch that it's at least worth checking out to see if it's something you might want. And for me, I think it's cool. I think it's very cool. I want to kind of start with almost like a half finishing move in this segment, because I painted a Harlequin over the last couple of days, and because I wanted to, now look, I painted a Death Jester and I want Death Jesters to be good. One of my early experiences with the Death Jester, when they had a sustained fire dice, and you could put orcs on a battle wagon and then move the battle wagon with your hand across the table. And if they fell off while you were moving it, they took damage.
Yeah, this was like second edition, right?
Yeah, but you could pile as many of them as you wanted on there. And I had a Death Jester shoot every single orc with sustained fire dice and then blow up the battle wagon. It was like he killed like 40 orcs and the battle wagon in one round of shooting. And I've been in love with the Death Jester ever since.
Oh, man.
That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, this, because you sustained fire, there was like a jam, a 1, 2, and a 3 on the die. When you rolled the die, and if it came up a number, that's how many hits you got. And then, anyway, we just went off. Probably the hottest rolling I've ever done in my life. But anyway, killed a lot of stuff. Awesome. Now, the Death Jester's gun is a shuriken cannon, this 24-inch range. And that's just not real good.
It doesn't seem like it would kill as many things in one round of shooting.
He's got an ability where he can like really super kill one guy, and if that guy happens to blow up and die, then something else happens. It's just not amazing, but it's still a really cool model. And I've been toying around with making Harlequin list, and unfortunately, making a Harlequin specific list, you just find yourself taking lots of the same unit over and over again. Like, okay, I need 5 transports and 5 troops and a solitaire and a couple of HQ guys. You know, that's what you find yourself taking. And so the models look great. But I think once you start getting into that like third squad of each, then they lose some of their uniqueness and in appeal. Anyway, it's hard to make in my mind a really good visually appealing Harlequin army, like a full size Harlequin army. But I still wanted to paint a Harlequin, so I figured I'd scratch the itch by painting a Troopmaster and a Death Jester.
You know, painting Harlequins is, man, there's so many words that come to mind when I think about endeavoring on that. sadomasochism, self-abuse.
Tedious Maximus.
Tedious Maximus, just all of those things. It's a daunting project, so hats off to you for getting after it.
Well, try to get out of my system with a couple of Harlequins first. You know, maybe the bug sticks, but I thought, you know, I just need to do this. I need to do it.
It's such a departure from painting almost anything else in the 40K universe. I mean, I think the closest thing I can get to painting clowns is orcs, maybe, because everything is so different as opposed to everything in the Imperium. There's uniforms, there's hard edges, There's Bright Lines, and even most of the Xenos armies. I mean, you're talking Necrons, Tau, still Bright Lines, uniformity, everything's the same. With Clowns, such awesome diversity in paint schemes and techniques that have to be employed.
So having just finished 9 Killicans, I can testify to Andrew's statement that orcs are very random.
it's the closest thing I can think of with painting clowns. And as divergent as they are in aesthetic, they're similar in terms of the actual physical painting of these models, is that no two are the same. It takes a tremendous amount of individual effort if you want to make them look as good as possible.
These things are all about building up confidence. That's why I say it's about like a half finishing move, because in order to do something like this, you need confidence in yourself, or at least in some capacity. You need the confidence that you can do it. You need the confidence to know that it's okay to fail. You need to see examples. You need to find out what your limits are. You know, it's a mind game as much as it is a skill game, I think, and a talent game when you go at about a project like this. So I watched several tutorials about people painting their Harlequins, and I found one, and this guy used the gnarliest brushes. I mean, the brushes didn't even have a sharp point. They had like hooked bristles. You know, sometimes that brush gets that hook at the end of it, right at the tip.
Yep.
Anybody got one of those?
I have several.
Wait, are those not supposed to be that way?
It's not, you know, this guy not, seemed to prefer it. I don't know.
Is that not the best way to paint models? Maybe I've been doing this wrong.
This guy painted some really good diamond patterns on his Harlequins with this hooked, gnarly brush. And I thought, if he can do that, I can do it with some better brushes than that. You know, at least whatever. With my fine detail brush that has not got that hook in it yet. I've certainly used some with the hook in it and thrown away some recently with the hook in it. I just replaced brushes. I had the same brushes for like 8.5 years, and I just replaced them. So I'm familiar with the hook. I'm not judging hook.
That's some longevity, though.
Yeah. Did you play taps or something when they were gone? Or?
I don't like, look, if they work, you know, whatever. You know, but anyway, I saw him painting with this gnarly thing and all, you know, all the tips we talked about. And I thought about, I'm just going to try to bring all that forward, including seeing this guy paint with these, you know, substandard tools to paint a good model. And I do. I like the outcome. And I posted some shots up on Twitter, and I'll try to put some where they're for more people can find them. But I set out to paint diamonds. Now, I went black and white too, because the death jester, I thought, you know, I'll keep it simple. I'm going to go black and white. Black and white is something I can use on other things. I can use them for orcs or different types of stuff, and make some black and white diamonds. Get familiar with the color. I have all the colors. Like, I knew that, like, I've got all the grays and the stuff to paint both a solid white, or a good white and a good black, and I'm good. And then I sit down to do this, and my diamonds turn into checkerboard. So he's got checkerboard going down one half of his long coat on his back, and a checker pattern going down his left leg. So on his lapel, he has some really good diamond shapes. And on his leg and the back right part of his long coat, he's got checkerboard. So I think it looks fine, and it's not like it's out of character for them, but that wasn't what I set out to do. So I went back to the internet and found some more tutorials. Well, I'd kind of forgotten about it, but Games Workshop Duncan Rhodes has a really good Harlequin tutorial out there. Now,
I think that's like, in terms of Duncan tutorials, that's the one where he prefaces it the most with like, this can be really hard, guys. Just so you know, this is going to be harder than the usual 1, 2, 3, you know, color, shade, highlight.
The hardest part is getting your pattern on the figure. And so what I did, instead of drawing it on with a paintbrush, I drew it on with a Micron pen. The Micron, they're like $3, $3, $4 on Amazon. It's the Spot 005 Micron. They come in different colors, too. So if you want a different border on your designs, you can get multitude of colors. But I drew it on with a pen. Didn't have to worry about messing around with a brush painting a thin line. But what I did was I made checks instead of diamonds. So what the tutorial that Duncan has was a great way of figuring out how to make the diamond pattern. And the way he did it was, I mean, I'll do the cliff notes. So the technique or the tip here is build up the confidence to do something that you weren't normally going to do, which is the whole subject of finishing moves, or one of the whole premises behind finishing moves. But in order to kind of overcome one of the things I knew was going to be very tedious for me, I went with the pen approach instead of the paintbrush approach. And I painted in the colors inside what became squares, started out being diamonds. But the way he did the diamonds was about finding the midpoint and then working out in halves away from that midpoint. So you can check out that tutorial. I won't retrace the tutorial there. That's why I said it's only kind of a half finishing move segment. But I'm really proud of where I came of the progress, and it's a good-looking model. I'll say that. I think it looks all right. It looks very Death Jester-y. I'm going to do a Troop Master next, and I'm going to use really bright colors. And I think that's what Andrew, you were talking about, is that it is it could be a harrowing experience.
That's what the Laughing God would want.
Yeah, man. Hats off to you. Get after it. I look forward to see the end result, and you know, better you than me. That's all I can say.
We'll see. I'm gonna keep going and do this as a, like I was talking about before with the Blood Angel and the cool shoulder pad from Pop Goes the Monkey, but the a palate cleanser, because I've been working on lots of terrain. I've been figuring, you know, man, gotta pro these tables up. I'm building some cool terrain to match the mats, like the mats from Frontline and stuff. I'm building terrain that's color appropriate, theme appropriate to the mats. And after I paint my next chemical plant or whatever, I'm like, I gotta get a model under my belt to make this feel like I'm still playing 40K.
Yep, some sanity hobby time.
Although the terrain is the third man, it's the third player, so it's a must have. You have to have it. And 8th edition is changes how terrain works a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've had this big we're undergoing this massive terrain painting for Warzone, and sweet goodness,
the armies that need it needs to have it there. Things like line of sight blocking,
changed so dramatically from 7th to 8th that basically if you had 50 tables worth of 7th edition terrain, you needed to make some very significant changes to make those tables really good and playable and rewarding for 8th edition games. Yeah. because the terrain rules change so much.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some army list stuff. Now, this week we're going to talk a little bit about Chaos Alpha Legion. We're going to talk about the Boogeyman list that are out there right now, or the soon-to-be Boogeyman list, if you haven't heard already. Alpha Legion is one of them. Next week we will discuss how to defeat Guard. Now, we mentioned earlier in the first part of the show that Andrew and I are going to play Guard coming up pretty soon, so it could just be us telling the stories of how we got our tanks pushed in for three rounds over the course of the weekend.
But, yes, it could be the tale of the Ford Pinto, Imperial Guard's style. So strap in for that and make sure you tune in, because we will have some great tips. And I really do think that there's some really kind of intuitive things that in my probably 20 plus games of playing Guard in 8th edition that my opponents consistently do wrong that I think would make their games against me and against other Guard players go much, much better. Definitely have some kind of, you know, the magician reveals his tricks type of conversations about how, if you're not a Guard player, don't know how those armies tick per se, that you can really go about defeating them.
So, yeah, well, that's coming up next week. Let's talk about Alpha Legion. Alpha Legion is super powerful, in my opinion. Every Chaos list that I've personally built. Now, we know that Khorne and World Eaters are incredibly powerful. They're somewhat one-dimensional, but it's a trick that works pretty consistently. And I think they are the takeaway easiest power build out of the Chaos book. I've said it before. You guys, after you've played some, may have disagree with me now, but I still feel that way. But Alpha Legion is a really, really close second, and it might even be more powerful.
Yeah, I would say that what's so unique about the Alpha Legion is that their Legion trait and their stratagem, when you combine them, you can have such incredible offense and such incredible defense in the exact same army. It just, in terms of how you choose to spin your command points and how you choose to deploy, that will let you either bring it to bear or hunker down for later.
I'm very much in the camp that Alpha Legion is the strongest one. I think it is better than World Eaters by a good margin. You know, reasonable minds can disagree, 1A, 1B, whatever. But I think the flexibility of Alpha Legion, and specifically, I mean, I think the stratagem we're talking about is called the forward operative stratagem for Alpha Legion. It's a single command point that allows you to, before the first movement phase, after everything is deployed, you may expend a command point to deploy that unit anywhere on the table, so long as it's more than 9 inches away or 9 inches away from any opposing model. But because it's before the game starts, it's not in a phase, which allows you to use more than one command point on the same stratagem. This isn't really a debatable or even a contentious ruling. It's very intentional.
It's there in the match play section. It even says things that happen before the game are exempt from that one only rule.
Exactly. This isn't gamey. You're not manipulating anything. You're not jumping through a rules loophole. It's quite literally intentional, very determinative by the rules designers, and expressly allowed in the core rulebook. So, you know, you can absolve your conscience of all wrongdoing if you want to spend 5 command points to deploy 5 units before the game starts.
Let me clarify one thing, though, just so it's – I know what you said, but I want to clarify that is use the stratagem when you can set up an Alpha Legion infantry unit during deployment. You set them up in concealment instead of placing on the table. So you're not getting around any deployment drops. I know that's not what you were saying, but I'm clarifying for anybody that's hearing this, is that you're not getting around deployment drops. You are deploying them in concealment, but then at the beginning of the first battle round, but before the first turn begins, the unit emerges from its hiding place. Set it up anywhere on the battlefield that is more than 9 inches away from any enemy models. And it's any enemy models, not outside the deployment zone or whatever. You're just 9 inches away from enemy models.
Yes, indeed. You're not exempting yourself from the drop. You know, if I want to stash a unit using this forward operative stratagem, I'm not. It doesn't reduce my drops by one. But importantly, especially now as the game trends away from lower drops, means you automatically go first. I mean, I think that Games Workshop has corrected that, and basically all the major tournaments have said, if you drop all your units first, you get a +1 to the go first roll. Well, whoop-de-doo, right? So a lot of times I think that stashing a unit in concealment or putting them in a reserve or something else like that really just forces your opponent to put his models on the table, and then you can deploy the stuff that you're putting on the table in a more advantageous position relative to where your opponent has deployed. But without getting too much into the weeds of that, I think it's important to note the most important, glaringly huge, massive thing, in my opinion, on this is that it happens before your deployment, which means I can put these guys on the table using this stratagem and they still get to move. They get to move and advance and shoot and assault as they would normally in your turn one, which means if I deploy these guys 9 inches away and they have a 6-inch move, now I'm looking at a 3-inch assault in my face. Very simplistic, but you can kind of extrapolate the power of this across an entire army if you list design for this particular idea.
Alpha Legion, anyway, you've heard us talk about this with the Noise Brain list that I built, is that Alpha Legion does not come pre-described with a mark of chaos that you have to take. So you can take any of the troops or any of the cult, I can't even say Legion Marine. What am I supposed to call World Eaters and Emperor's Children now? Or Noise Marines and Berserkers now? What's going to be the shorthand term for those guys? They're not cult troops anymore. They're not Legion troops.
They're still cult troops, right? I guess they're just not troops. They're cult elites, I guess.
The cult units? The Legion-specific unit? I mean, they're not that. Yeah. I think cult troops still works.
Whatever. You know what I'm talking about. You could take Noise Marines. You could take Zerks. You could take Thousand Sons. Rubric Marines, and still inside an Alpha Legion or any of the non-specific marked legions.
And that's one of the things that makes the Alpha Legion so good, is you have access to such a diverse group of units that not only do they just become 17% tougher versus ranged attacks over 12 inches, but you have this crazy way to let them get into position right away. And that's such a huge benefit to an army that does not have drop pods and very few units can teleport.
Marines, yes. In this, you know, Marine bodies, Marine point size, so you're not going to have a ton. You're not filling out a brigade, I don't think, with Alpha Legion. You're going to be filling out a couple of detachments. You might have 9 command points, but this is the stratagem we're talking about. You might only have 6, but even then, the forward operative's stratagem is only 1 command point.
Yeah, and it only takes the use of one of these command points, like Andrew said earlier, to totally change how your opponent will start to deploy. I don't care what you're playing. If my first command point is to put a unit of Alpha Legion Berserkers into concealment, you will deploy differently than if I hadn't done that.
Yeah, like, no doubt.
That's crazy. The amount of game impact you have right away is so huge.
I also, I kind of want to, I mean, you mentioned it in passing earlier. But it's so there's the forward operative stratagem, which I think is really, really huge. And then there's just the base Alpha Legion trait that it's just not a stratagem. You know, Bernie points for it. It just comes innately with every single Alpha Legion unit you buy that says, hey, if I'm more than 12 inches away from you, you're minus one to hit me. Massive, huge, huge upsides on that. I think it's really, really strong, especially if used in tandem with some tools that are already available to Chaos, such as the Changeling, etc. So that's awesome, and kind of the eye-catching allure of playing Alpha Legion.
Well, shooting's very, very powerful. I mean, we're talking about guard as being like the boogeyman list. They rely on shooting. Guard's not beating you down typically. They're going to be trying to shoot at you on needing four pluses to hit most of the time.
Right, and now they're needing five pluses to hit. I mean, that's a massive degradation of guard's ability.
When we're talking about a D6, anytime you move that pip one way or another, it's a big percentage swing for or against you. It's something to be aware. When you see that happening, you want to be aware of it and play into it or play against it or whatever's best for you at the time. You have to consider it.
I think it's the other thing that I think was most alluring about the Alpha Legion is this fire twice stratagem. But in short, it just allows a unit, you just pick one, and this guy gets to shoot twice in the shooting phase.
Yeah, if you are a Slaanesh unit, right, then you get the endless cacophony, and you are simply at the end of the shooting phase, that unit gets to shoot again because you have this other stratagem that, well, if one, A, you have the Legion trait, which makes you tougher, and B, you have the stratagem to get you into position, you can make this super hammer like appear out of nowhere.
The
and
endless
stuff
cacophony,
away.
It's two command points. That's sure. That's not insignificant. It is, especially if you're doing this with, if you're trying to operative several of your units, and then that is select a Heretic Astartes, Slaanesh infantry or biker unit. That unit can immediately shoot again.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it
two
is.
Command
it's
points.
A big deal.
That's fine.
Now, would that work with something like obliterators?
If they're Mark of Slaanesh, it would.
And infantry.
Which obliterators are?
I believe they can have both of those things. I'll tell you in just 1 second. Obliterators do get a Mark of Chaos, and they are infantry.
Yeah. So
I kind of feel like that would hurt.
yeah, it'd be pretty good. It would not be bad.
They're assault four, but it's a single gun, and we've kind of. We have counseled people against inclusion of obliterators when they were two shots. Now that there are four shots with no appreciable point increase, they could be a unit to go to.
I played against a Alpha Legion Slaanesh build very recently. Played a couple games against him, really competent. And he was just, there were some margins in his list design that we discussed after our game. And he said the obliterators were kind of a last man in, first man out type. In the athletic community, we call them bubble teams. Did they make the tournament? They're kind of the first one in, last one in, first one out type unit. So maybe obliterators aren't the best, but I think in the right circumstances and depending on your meta, they might be a really, really good choice. Obviously, for their points, there may be more effective choices.
I like them. I've liked them in previous editions because they had the ability to do quality deep strike, and they can still do that. And so you could, if you were playing an army, and this is just me describing a scenario where I might consider them, is that if you were playing an army that wanted to push up in your opponent's face while it's forward operative rules, you could use the teleport strike with this unit and not have to burn combat points and yet still put them someplace that could threaten or influence how your opponent deploys.
Well, yeah. I think that's exactly what you would do if you were going to do obliterators with Alpha Legion.
I also think, though, that it shouldn't be overlooked that they're also just super survivable if they don't deep strike. I mean, I think in the two games I played, my opponent was like, man, I really shouldn't have put these guys out, deep struck them in the one game or deployed them out on the wing. They're a really great fire base option as well. If you've got the Changeling in your list and some Alpha Legion obliterators, all of a sudden you're talking about really hard to hit durable, or if you've got a Chaos Lord, if you've got Abaddon kind of anchoring 20 or 30 Noise Marines with Alpha Legion, and Marcus Lanesh, well, all of a sudden you're rerolling a hit. You're minus one for them to hit you. You can double tap with some command points, blah, blah, blah. All of those great options will lend themselves well to obliterators just deploying on the table and being good backfield fire support.
I'm in full agreement with this statement.
Yeah. I think that I may have cut somebody's point off earlier, and I apologize. We were talking about how the Alpha Legion and Slaanesh is a pretty good combination.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the go-to combination. We'll see how it shakes out. I've managed to get a few games in. Let's just say I've been very happy with the results.
With Noise Marines getting those three shots apiece, and the Blastmasters, I think are questionable, but I don't think I was in the right. I don't think I was playing against the right opponent to see the value of a Blastmaster. But the Sonic Blasters were great.
Well, I think the other thing too is what I really like about the Noise Marines, especially in the Alpha Legion and all that, is that they're a really good response to one of the other big boogeyman list archetypes, that being the rowboat gun line. And by rowboat, I mean Robute Gilliman. We just call him Rowboat Gilligan in my meta. But if you've got the rowboat gun line, especially in the most common iterations that I've seen, it's either a parking lot of Razorbacks, or you've got this whole slew of Devastator Marines with the banner of Reflection, where if you kill somebody, then on a 3+, they get to shoot back for free. That's incredibly strong, right? Rowboat is a huge boogeyman and an absolute powerhouse in terms of competitive armies. But I think that the Alpha Legion and the Noise Marines really mitigate that list design, because if I kill a Devastator Marine with a 3-shot bolter, or if I open up my Noise Marines and I just blow away a Devastator squad. Well, when they roll those 3+s because of the lieutenant with the banner and that they could shoot back, and I hope most of our listeners know what I'm talking about. I'm sure they do because they're scarred psychologically.
Well, you take the ancient with the banner, and then it gets I forget the actual name of the banner, but there is a banner that allows them to.
Yes, we all. I feel like everybody knows what we're talking about.
It's a great relic banner.
It's incredibly. It's all over the internet. What I think is wonderful about these Noise Marines is that when you shoot back at them with a las cannon or a missile launcher or a multi melter or something like that, the return fire is ablated because it's more bodies. The volume of fire is still there. The ability, the survivability is still there, but they're not dying in mass. Or it's not like a las cannon's doing 6 damage to a manticore, or 5 wounds to Magnus or something like that. No. At best, that opposing Devastator is going to kill a 15-point Chaos Space Marine. And I think that offensive output mixed with innate survivability, and then the third factor of just ablative wounds, because there's kind of a lot of bodies, really, really makes that list design very, very powerful, especially when matched up against what's on the top of the heap right now.
I think you were also referencing the Changeling's Locus of Transmogrification ability. That is a friendly Zinch demon unit within 9 inches of this model. When they are attacked or surrounded by a twisting aura of change, your opponent must subtract 1 from the hit rolls for attacks on the unit. That's for only friendly Zinch demon units within 9 inches.
And do obliterators have the demon special rule?
Yes, it's possible for the Changeling to benefit obliterators and possessed, because they can be both a demon and Zinch.
And decimators as well, isn't that correct?
Yes, but decimators would not have the Alpha Legion benefit because they are not Hellbrutes.
Certainly, that's correct. I'm just saying that if you've got a Mark of Zinch Alpha Legion obliterator within 9 inches of the Changeling, I'm -2 to shoot them.
Which you could do.
Correct. You could do that.
And it's not super cost prohibitive, right? I mean, well, it's pricey.
I mean, I know what you're talking about, buying the Changeling and stuff, but like,
buying the Changeling, you don't pay anything points. For the marks. Right. You're not paying anything for the marks. You're not paying anything for the Alpha Legion. So you're paying for 100 points for the Changeling, and then all of a sudden you've got this immense backfield fire support that's -2 to hit. Like, that's bonkers. Like, hey, Imperial Guardsmen, I guess you're needing 6s now to shoot me. And I'm very, very survivable, especially if I'm in cover, et cetera. So
yeah, Abolition is very, it's got a lot of options you can do, which is very themey in itself, right? Is that even power gaming? Because that's what they would do anyway. Is that what happens when, isn't it great when the power game meets the fluff?
It is. It's a very good time to be playing Chaos.
Yeah, I'm excited, especially with the big chaos FAQ. I should say we use the term FAQ in our circles. I mean, as gamers, but we're really talking about erratas. Chaos Space Marines got errated to include the cult troops now. In if you take the appropriate legions, then so world eaters, those berserkers become troops if you're taking a world eater legion. The same thing with Noise Marines if you're taking a Slaanesh, Emperor's Children legion. And that's big. So those are the things that we're talking about. Do you give up that? Do you give up the troop category to do something with these types of units in an Alpha Legion build?
I would say in this particular case, yes, because the Alpha Legion cultist is so ridiculously good. You have a 4-point model that you get a Legion trait that makes you tougher, and then.
Sense of harder to hit. I mean, that equates to less wounds, for sure.
I mean, tougher in the sense of it takes more offense to make you dead.
Yeah, just clarifying for...
Right.
We get a lot of questions. Did you mean he got a +1 toughness? No, what you're talking about is he's harder to remove from the table.
Harder to remove from the table. And then you can use the Alpha Legion stratagem to infiltrate the cultists or to conceal them. And you might think, well, it doesn't really matter. Cultists aren't that good. But if you have a block of 40, you can put wherever you want in whatever shape you want all over the board. That's really big in terms of early game board control.
That's an intimidating unit, by the way, too. People will attempt to try to burn it down or do something to it, especially if you choose to operative them up on an objective that's important.
Now hit him with that creme de la creme, Horton, about that. I think it's a three command point stratagem that allows you to just show back up with a unit at full power.
It's two combat points.
Two command points, I'm sorry.
The Tide of Traitors.
Whew, hotness.
Yeah, that's really good. But I've used that a few times now. I think you're only really going to use that if you have a unit of 40. But when you do have a unit of 40, it is very nice to be like, well, they're back. So
yeah, I mean, I don't even know if it's only when you have a unit of 40. It is use the stratagem at the end of the movement phase. If you do, pick a unit of a Chaos Cultist and remove it from the battlefield. You can then set them up again wholly within 6 inches of the table edge of the battlefield and more than 9 inches from any enemy models at its full starting strength. Now, look, we've already talked about how you're going to be strapped for command points. So late game, we're talking about theoretical command points you might have. Right, but maybe not, especially after you've infiltrated three units in endless cacophony at one time. You're not going to have a bunch of all these phantom command points hanging around. But if you do, you could put that 20-man unit right on the relic, right on somebody's Emperor's Will, right in a table quarter, anywhere you need it to be.
Yeah, within 6 of a board edge, but yes.
Well, sure, yeah. You're right. Yeah, you set them up with wholly within 6 inches of a table edge. And it is at the end of the movement phase that's very important, so you wouldn't get a free move.
No, yeah. Your unit has to survive morale and shooting and everything, and then you can basically remove them to put them back.
Yeah.
So it's good for sure.
Yeah, so I don't think at that stage of the game you're going to have the command points to spare, but, you know, if you do, it's still very extremely powerful.
Well, I think that this is a good – Alpha Legion is a great kind of case study in – list designing to maximize command points. Obviously, I think that with 8th edition, we're seeing a lot of find the best thing in your army and then put a bunch of those on the table. I think for Chaos, for example, it's decimators. Well, you know, put 6 decimators on the table, and lo and behold, with Abaddon and like, man, really?
Why do you think that? Is it because the weapon auto hits?
Oh, well, I mean, it just wounds. It does mortal wounds on hits.
Yeah.
Right, and it has, you know, you can move, advance, and still shoot it, so it has a pretty massive effective range. They're very survivable, and then if you have Abaddon, they're rerolling to hit, right? So you're doing mortal wounds on threes, rerolling ones.
The Decimator is a Forge World model that's out of the Index Chaos Astartes from Forge World.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievably powerful. And so I was just using that as an example of kind of the traditional axiom says, find the best unit in your army and then put as many of those onto the table as possible. And that's how you can win a lot of games. Guard says Tauroxes. Ultramarine says Razorbacks, whatever it is. I think with Alpha Legion, we're seeing kind of the apex of what Games Workshop was hoping to accomplish with the stratagems. And that is, you can actually build an arguably better list, not by spamming decimators, but instead by building a battalion or brigade-sized detachment and then using the command points to achieve victory as opposed to individual units and spamming those. So it'll be interesting to see as it kind of plays out and what kind of tournament lists arise out of it. Overall, I think Alpha Legion, though, is very, very powerful.
Agreed, agreed. Let's go ahead and wrap up with that. Next week, we will come back and talk more about Guard, specifically around how to get an edge on Guard. And this is one of the things we talked about, at least in this list, has the potential to do so because you can, you know, get real close or stay far away and be durable and score points or whatever. But we'll talk about that next week. You guys got anything else you want to add before we get out of here?
Kill the Manticores first.
Here, here.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Cheers.
Good night.
Thanks for listening.